Well, welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our podcast project on rethinking sex education. As you know, I try each week to post some thoughts here to help us get a conversation started about hammering out a viable, a helpful way to educate our young people about sex. And I do hope you'll join in. I hope you'll comment. And I do want to thank many who have, because, again, at the end of this project, I'll take the things that we learned together and I'll turn them into a book. So let's begin this week's episode. The title of this one is, When Should I Start Having Sex, Dad? This is part two of three. Now, in the last episode, we heard stories of two parents who were digging into their own sexual stories to help them get ready to have talks with their kids. And like many, they were looking for effective ways to prepare their kids for healthy sexual journeys. The first of the story was wounded by the emptiness of the Wild West, no sex, no rules, sex rules. They wanted better for their kids. The second story had been hurt by the traditional, the no sex before marriage rule, and that man also wanted better for his kids. So those two stories reflect a quest on the part of parents to reconcile religion's ancient wisdom about human sexuality with this seismic cultural shift that our society is undergoing. Those parents were looking for guidelines that they can give to their kids to help them move forward and have healthy sexual lives. Now, in this episode, I'm going to suggest some first steps toward sexual guidelines about when our young people are ready to start having sex. And we'll talk about how to help them think through their readiness. And we'll suggest some rough draft ideas that we could perhaps shape into easy to remember, easy to transmit rules of thumb. Now, our starting place for this discussion has to be acknowledging this moment in history. We said several episodes that 100 years ago, we had sex rules that helped us integrate ancient wisdom into our lives. And 100 years from now, we will again. But right now, we really are trying to find our way forward. We're stumbling and we're figuring and we're trial and error-ing. We're experimenting. Which makes it really important that we support one another, because we really need to collaborate together during this time. We need to put our heads together and support one another in this challenge, but that's not what most are doing. Most are locked in the throes of a social debate. And when we're in a time of debate, we tend to gather with people who think like we do and snipe at the ignorance or the wickedness of the folks on the other side, which, again, isn't helping us at all that much. We need people in this endeavor with us. We need collaborators in on it with us. It's not easy digging into our own sexual stories or dismantling our own sexual pain. It's not easy trying to understand where our original sex rules came from or rethink them and try out new ones. It's not easy thinking thoughts that we've never thought before or trying things we've never tried before. So we deeply need community. Family, that's a good place to start the conversation about when young people should start having sex. But thinking countercultural thoughts with only family, that's a lonely way to go. Alone, it's much more likely that our own baggage will muck up the works. Alone, we limit the new ideas that will occur to us. We really need a community. Young people highly prioritize input from their peer group. So if we have a conversation about when to start having sex and it happens only inside of our family, even if we have brilliance to offer, even if we get the conversation completely right, most likely our kids will conclude that those ideas are just mom and dad and their weirdness about sex. So again, that makes having this conversation in the context of community really important. Social norms are powerful. And we do a better job imagining what those norms would be when we're together, and we do a better job integrating those norms into our lives when we're together. This project originated in my own spiritual community. We wanted to normalize sex conversations between kids and parents and grandparents and uncles and aunts, and we wanted our families and our youth leaders to be thinking about this together. And so we were looking for a shared way to talk about and to practice the sexual journey. People standing together to support one another, this is powerful. Even when religion was guilting and shaming and tabooing, one thing we were getting right was the groupiness of our endeavor. Now, in this project, we have not shied away from the toxic instincts that the church has brought to sexuality. Way back in episode 11, the title was Subtle Like Cancer. We've been really explicit about how we have allowed dirty sex and shame and misogyny to corrupt our ancient wisdom. But even when we lost our way, the desire for a group to pursue health and well-being together, That was a really good instinct. Now, our attempts, misguided as they've often been, our attempt was to find best practices and then support one another in following them. Several episodes ago, I mentioned a mom who was feeling nostalgic for the days when old folks imposed a healthy dose of shame, that was her quote, on young folks. Now, her point really was not how wonderful shame is, of course not. Her point reflected a real longing for the support and for the security that exists when a community shares reinforcing norms. And the job of our generation really is to hammer out those new norms. It's our job to create rules of thumb that both support the big picture sexual journey and take into account the 15-year problem that we saw in the last episode. And again, in this regard, community is our friend. We go to the gym more faithfully when we go with friends. We meditate more regularly when we meditate with friends. We follow healthy sexual norms better when we talk these things over with friends. So yes, we begin the conversation at home, but as soon as we can, we move it to a broader circle. As soon as we can, we share the conversation with others who are also thinking through the issues that we've been raising. Now, church community is an ideal place for this shared norm making. When I know that you're having this conversation with your kids, and you know that I'm having it with mine, and we both know that our youth group leaders are framing sexual discussions along these same lines, our young people come to know the norms, but are also supported as the group together tries to keep the norms. The point of this project has been to gather in one place both religion's accumulated wisdom about the sexual journey and the crazy that so often shoots us in the foot. My hope is that families and communities will use the material to work together toward simple sexual rules of thumb that help guide our young people toward healthy sexual journeys. Meeting our kids where they are. As I'm writing this, I am thinking about two young people in our own community who were raised on our sex discussions. Both of them came to their families to talk about when they should start having sex. And in both cases, their families suggested they wait longer than they had in mind. And in both cases, social pressure and biological urges and raw curiosity won the day, and both became sexually involved really before they were ready. However, because they had engaged the conversation, they were both positioned to learn from their experiences. They were both able to continue having the conversations after the fact and to apply the ancient wisdom in hindsight. And so today, some time later, they're still learning and growing and moving forward in much healthier ways. They've been able to continue seeking and searching because they've been in the context of a loving community. Now, learning after the fact, that's not an easy idea for a lot of church folk. Our community's youth minister told me a story about a sex talk he once heard given to some young people, not our young people. So to illustrate his talk, the speaker unwrapped a piece of gum during his speaking, chewed it, and then he tried to put it back in the wrapper. And this, he said, this is what happens to you once you have sex. You were one way before sex. Afterwards, you're another way. The implication being kind of a used up, chewed up way. So, he concluded, don't have sex until you get married, because you'll never be able to get back to the way that you were. Now, those who've been following the podcast will recognize the framework that this speaker was working from. His chewing gum illustration reflected the property rights and dirty sex instincts that crept into our tradition way back in the second and third centuries. And most of us don't want the chewing gum message to be the message we give our young people. But in defense of the speaker, the reason we fall into extreme strategies like that, he was promoting the not until you're married sex rule, and remember what we said about it in the last episode. It was a really good rule for a really long time. It protected a lot of people from a lot of pain. It aligned a lot of people with a great deal of wisdom. But again, as we've seen, our world has changed. And now, 71% of our kids are sexually active by the time they're 18. But by the way, that comes from the American Academy of Pediatrics. It comes from their journal. Statistically, the experience of those two young people in our community is the more common scenario. Most people will probably become sexually active before they are ready. That's the culture we live in. In all likelihood, community's contribution, the wisdom of the spiritual community or the loving community, will most frequently be given to our young people after the fact. In most cases, we'll be able to help young people learn from their sexual decisions after the fact. Most commonly, we'll help young people see when they've gone too far to the left or to the right, and a way to hone in on the center wisdom of the middle way, finding their way to a healthy sexuality. Now, if we create the environment for sexual discussions in the context of family and community that normalize it, we enhance the possibility that they'll learn from their mistakes. It's no small thing to be able to help young people see how ancient wisdom could have informed their path. It's no small thing to help them see a bigger picture, make a correction, find a better way forward. But that's tough because, as we've seen, church carries a lot of taboo feelings around sexuality. And taboo feelings work against this dynamic. Many of us know exactly what that speaker was saying because we feel the chewing gum feelings. And we feel something gets undone when our young people have sex. And we feel the taint. And we feel the pollution. We feel the corruption that sex causes. Now, even if those feelings don't come from our conscious minds, many of us carry a nagging sense that sex causes something precious to be lost. And if we have those feelings, you can be sure they're going to leak out. And if we do, and if they do, they're usually going to shut down any further dialogue. A few episodes back, I mentioned an axiom I often repeated to my kids when they were growing up. Stupid people don't learn from their mistakes. Smart people do, but brilliant people learn from other people's mistakes. Love them though we do. Most of our kids are not going to be brilliant. But they can be smart. We enhance the possibility of them being smart and learning from their mistakes if we keep dialogue open with them. In particular, if we frame our conversations without the guilt and shame instincts that crept in 1,800 years ago. Now, in an earlier context, we talked about white bread sex. Well, that same metaphor applies to premature or casual sexual experiences. White bread is full of empty calories. It gives us momentary energy, but it doesn't give us the nutrients we need over the long term. It doesn't give us the minerals, the vitamins that we need. Those get stripped out when we process the flour. White bread meets our most basic needs, but leaves our long-term needs unnourished. Well, casual or premature sex is like that. It addresses an immediate need. It satisfies a young person's curiosity. It ticks a box that helps them feel validated or normal or accepted. It addresses some pressing biological urge, but it doesn't address the long-term human longings that we've been outlining in this project. If you're interested in health, one of the first dietary rules that you get is no white bread. It's what dietitians call a never food, because it's just not a good idea. It's not taboo. It's not toxic. It's not poisonous. Its harm comes because it masquerades as real food. It feels like it satisfies our hunger, but in fact, it does not. That's why we need to help our kids be very circumspect about the white bread threat posed by premature or casual sexual encounters. Are kids getting sexually active too soon? It happens. Our bodies are wired for it. Our social norms are now condoning it. It happens. It will happen. It won't help our cause if we default to the chewing gum story and frame premature sex as a failure from which they can't recover. But it also won't help them either if we don't help them sidestep white bread sexual encounters. When we offer our kids an understanding of the whole sexual journey, we have to warn them about the hazards of white bread sex. We offer them an empowering perspective about a lifetime of sexual health and well-being when we introduce them to the long-term thinking that, as young people, they would otherwise miss. So, toward some new rules of thumb. Now, again, the challenge before us is to work out new sex rules for our new world. And again, we probably won't have the definitive list for a while, but informed by the ancient wisdom, we can take a stab at some guidelines. So let's do that. Let's have some rough draft ideas here. Number one, taking the casual out. Way back in episode 4, we saw how sex chemicals help form long-term sexual bonds. We saw how our bodies make casual sex a contradictory term. Sex, both the one-night stand and the committed versions, release bonding chemicals in our brains, chemicals that create attachments and help us form non-casual relationships. Now, we can deaden the effects of those chemicals by ignoring the bonding that they generate. We can, and we do. We normalize casual sex. But when we do, we're working against the attaching process that is wired into our bodies, into our brains, and into our hearts. Our bodies are wired to make sex not remain casual. And when we deaden that bonding force, we're working against the ancient wisdom that is wired right into our bodies. Well, that's a good place to start developing some rules of thumb to give our kids. Casual sex isn't casual. There are casual relationships, and there are sexual relationships, but the two don't go together. Now, our society has inadvertently divorced erotic sex from long-term relationships. Sex might lead to a committed relationship, but just as likely, it might not. So if we streamline the ancient wisdom down to a few rules of thumb for our kids, this is a good one. Hooking up without commitment harms us. Feeling the obligatory pressure that if we've been on 3 dates and we still like each other, we should jump into bed, that works against our long-term sexual well-being. That's a good rule of thumb. Don't share orgasms until you can envision growing old together. Don't get into bed together until you've done the things people do to get ready for a long-term relationship. Until you've become dear friends. That's the philos love we looked at. Until you've given the relationship the time that it takes for all those internal processes that we looked at in the earlier episodes. Don't have sex until you've had time to assess compatibility, until you know that you share expectations about where life will take you. And a corollary rule of thumb is that it's not a good idea to have sex until you've ridden out the mania stage of lovemaking. That irrational chemical bonding stage of making love, that has enough power and has enough draw of its own. It doesn't need the additional fuel of erotic sexuality to sustain it. By its very nature, mania makes thoughtful, considered reflection virtually impossible. It makes careful consideration of suitability or readiness or maturity or compatible. It makes it impossible to assess those. So, it's an especially good idea to wait to start having sex until that stage has stormed its way through, and that usually takes several months. So, rough draft rule number one, take the casual out. Rough draft rule number two, build the long-term in. We're ready to start having sex when we're in a relationship we believe will go the distance. Now, the relationship may not last a lifetime, but wisdom dictates that we not start having sex before we have a sense that it will. In the basest of terms, young person, if you don't want your relationship to last a lifetime, don't have sex. If we build into our sexual relationships the upfront expectations that they'll go the distance, we create a cascading set of corollary expectations. We build in healthy levels of commitment. We build in mutual assurances. We make deep psychological and emotional pledges to one another. We start the psychological and the emotional and relational processes on which successful pair bonds are built. We aren't ready for sex until both partners have a clear picture in their mind of a shared future together. They've explored and found to be compatible their future life expectations. Their economic and career goals are compatible. Their dreams and their values and their spirituality are not, and the non-negotiables in their life, these are compatible. That's a rule of thumb that builds on the work of Dr. Morris that we saw in episodes 16 and 17. Our hearts and our minds are not ready for relational demands of physical intimacy until we've done the deep and the intimate life sharing that goes with the readiness stages of sexual touch. Third, it's a good idea to ask the readiness questions, assessing readiness. To help us have these readiness conversations with our young people, below, I'm going to read you a series of questions that condense the principles that we've outlined in the earlier sections of this project into a handy reference list to help us get ready to talk about what's involved when we start having sex. First question, young person. Have you given philos love the time that it needs? We explored 5 Greek stages of lovemaking. We saw that the chemical stages come with an urgency of their own. But when we become too physical too early, philos love, friendship love, often gets shortchanged. So a good first question to help our young people assess their readiness for sex is how deep their friendship has gone. Now, our culture has normalized introducing sexual touch very early in a relationship. But when we start making out, we tend to stop talking. The Philos love question is a question about pacing. It helps our young people assess the time and the space that they've given to their friendship. It helps us discuss the psychological and emotional processes that Dr. Morris outlined. We encourage them to give the relationship the time that it needs for the friendship dynamic to unfold in a healthy way, in a natural way. Next question. Are you ready to sustain a committed relationship? Sexual relationships are demanding. They require energy and time and bandwidth. There's a lot required of a young person to get ready for life. There's education to pursue. There's personal development projects. The question about sustaining a committed relationship is a question about readiness as the young people are in the throes of figuring out who they are, where they're going. Those questions take time and energy. One of the primary jobs of young people is to develop the virtue and character that they're going to need to carry them through life. They're in the throes of discerning what kind of personality they brought with them into this world and how they should focus it and focus their passions and their energies. They've got a lot going on. And the can you sustain a relationship question is a question about discerning their readiness. It asks if their life projects will allow them to reallocate energy right now, because relationships take a lot of energy. It asks if they've moved their young person duties far along enough to dilute their focus on them by introducing a committed relationship. It really is a question about how established they are in their personal identity. It's a question about how far their life preparedness has gone. It's not really even a sexual question, it's a readiness question. It asks them to consider the youthful requirements that we explored in episode 16. Have they slain their dragons? Do they know what their dragons are? Have they found their fortunes? Have they outwitted their witches? Are they established enough in their sense of self to be able to think of a committed us? Are they able to sustain a relationship? The next question we want to help people, help our young people process, are you ready to say no as well as yes? When we place sexual activity into the context of committed relationship, every sexual yes is also a sexual no. To say yes to one partner, we say no to all the others. In a conversation about sexual readiness, this is an important thing to discern. Do our young people have a clear idea about what to look for in a sexual partner? Physical and even emotional attraction, that's important. But as we've seen, it's not the whole story. It's a question about having time to summer them and winter them. You remember that from episode 16. It's a question about assessing their readiness for exclusivity as well as their partner's readiness for exclusivity. The question invites a conversation about their readiness to go public with this partner. Are they ready to introduce this person as their partner to the people who matter to them? Are they ready to give exclusive loyalty to this person? Are they experienced enough to assess accurately if their partner's ready to do the same and give exclusive loyalty to them? And what about trust? Can they give an exclusive level of trust to this partner, or can they offer the kind of trustworthiness to their partner that would allow them to return that kind of trust? Next question. Are you ready for sacrifice? All of the wisdom we've explored builds selflessness right into our sexual relationships. We assess our readiness for sex when we assess how highly we prioritize our partners. It's a question that invites consideration of the young person's ability to give to the other the time and the energy and the self-effacing prioritization that is required of committed relationships. Are they mature enough to even have this ability? Have they grown enough to be able to give themselves this way? A good question for our young people before starting to have sex is, can you contend for your partner's well-being with the same vigor and sacrifice that you would contend for your own? Is our young person mature enough to see in their relationship not only what they will get, but also what they will give? Can they see the bigger picture than the fire in their bellies? Can they see the bigger picture than the social status that a sexual relationship will grant them? Can they see the bigger picture than how a relationship will mitigate their loneliness? Are they ready to give themselves to the better or worse, good times and bad requirements that go with committed relationships? And can they do it for the time span that committed relationships entail and through all the challenges that committed relationships undergo? Finally, are you able to honor your partner's sexuality? We explored this question when we looked at the yin and yang of masculine and feminine sexuality. We saw that our culture has been particularly dismissive of feminine sexual instincts. It's a question of insight as well as readiness and selflessness. Are our young people able to understand both sexual energies and then able to honor their partner's sexuality, the sexual instincts and energies that they do not possess? And are they ready and able to teach their partner to honor their sexuality? It's a place many relationships go wrong, and the question is, are they ready to bring balance to this socially inherited imbalance? Those are the questions. Now, in practical terms, if we help our young people work through them, we help them think through the ancient wisdom. And if we help them make these assessments before they begin a sexual relationship, it will limit the number of sexual partners they'll have in a lifetime. There are a limited number of times in our lives that we can work through those questions and make those levels of commitment. Asking and answering these really does slow down the sexual train. Also, in practical terms, there are not many teenagers in the world able to make the commitments that these questions call for. Most people are not emotionally ready to answer these questions well before they're into their early 20s. Now that, admittedly, that is a hard pill to swallow in the wild west of sex that we live in. The questions are demanding. But they're demanding because the ancient wisdom is demanding. The ancient wisdom compels us to start having sex cautiously. The ancient wisdom insists that we do some challenging upfront work before we get into bed together. And in our current climate, that's a hard message to hear. But again, anything worth having is worth working hard for. And sexual relationships that draw us into the deepest longings of our heart, these are worth working for. These are worth a tremendous amount because they help us avoid the heartache that we so often sustain when those deep longings are not fulfilled. So yes, it's worth working for. Now in the next episode, we'll explore how we might approach the 15-year problem. We'll hit that next time. In the meantime, as always, I'd love to hear what you're thinking. Post it to the blog or on the Facebook page, and I look forward to hearing what's on your mind.